from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we'll get your reaction to the U.S. airstrike that killed a top Iranian general and has spurred a dramatic escalation in tensions between Washington and Tehran. First, though, we'll dig into California's new data privacy law that took effect the first of the year. It will give Californians more rights over their personal information, but what will you need to do to reap the benefits of these new data privacy protections? That's next on Forum, after this news. Welcome to Forum and Happy New Year, Forum Friday listeners. I'm Mina Kim. With a new year, of course, comes new laws. And if you've been noticing more emails, notifications, or pop-up banners from companies announcing privacy policy updates, it's because California's data privacy law, known as the California Consumer Protection Act, or CCPA, went into effect on January 1st. It's considered the toughest privacy law in the nation, but what it really does and how you'll benefit, that's what we'll get into in this opening hour of Forum. Joining me is Alistair McTaggart. He's president of Emerald Fund, Inc. and founder of Californians for Consumer Privacy. His original ballot measure was the starting point for the CCPA. Welcome to Forum, Alistair McTaggart.
Good morning. Pleased to be here.
Glad to have you. Jennifer King is also with us. She's Director of Consumer Privacy at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Hello, Dr. King.
Good morning, Mina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Haley Tsukuyama. She's a legislative activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She joins us as well. Haley Tsukuyama, welcome to Forum.
Hi, good morning.
So let me start with you, Haley. I feel like it's always important when we start these conversations about data privacy to remind our listeners just how much data is collected about us, what businesses and companies know about us.
Yeah. So certainly businesses and companies know a lot about us, you know, and some of that is, you know, what we volunteer for, you know, for services. So you may say, you know, here's my phone number so they can give me a call back. And what's important about the California Consumer Privacy Act is that it lets you ask companies not only sort of what information they've collected about you over the years, you know, your location, places you frequent, things you buy, that kind of thing, but also who else they've shown that information to. And so it really gives you visibility into this like broad ecosystem of, of these huge profiles that companies have made about you and where that information has gone.
So then, Haley, at its core, what does the CCPA do for consumers?
Sure. So the CCPA gives people a right to know what information companies have about them and sort of who they've shared or shown that information to. It gives them a right to delete information, right? So to say to a company, you know what, you have this information on me, I don't want you to have it anymore. And it also gives you the right to opt out of the sale of that information. So you can say, you know, I don't want you to give that to anybody else. So three pretty basic rights.
And this law applies to what kinds of companies?
It applies to, really companies that collect data of a certain size. So, you know, there are some revenue restrictions. There are some things about, you know, how many consumers they have data on. Generally speaking, companies that collect data.
So, Jennifer King, then how do you characterize this law? Is it a game changer in terms of data collection?
Well, it's definitely a good first step, given that we don't have virtually any other laws in this space, either at the federal level or at most states. I don't know how much the average consumer's experience is really going to be affected by this from a day-to-day perspective, mostly because there's a lot of burden on you to take action and to avail yourself of those rights. I don't know if it will curb some of the more excessive behavior we've seen on the part of companies, but it may, just because when you're actually being held to a standard and there's a certain amount of transparency, that might actually make some companies change their practices. But whether it truly kind of stops the entire data ecosystem of buying and selling or collecting without our awareness, I think that remains to be seen.
Mm. So before we dig into what we would need to do to be able to make sure that we are fully benefiting from the protections that are in this law. I want to ask you, Alistair McTaggart, if you agree with Jennifer King's assessment. I mean, are you happy with what the CCPA, the California Consumer Privacy Act, ended up being when it was finally passed?
Sure. And so if I could just add a couple of things to what Haley said, one other important thing the law does, in addition to what she said, is it now creates a heightened responsibility for companies to protect your data. There are very serious consequences for companies now if they don't take reasonable steps to protect your data, like encrypting it or redacting it. And that's to help combat the scourge of identity theft, which is something that consumers care about deeply. And, you know, in terms of what Dr. King said, yes, I agree it's a first step. I've never sort of held it out there as, you know, there's one easy answer for all this stuff. I feel about privacy the way I think, you know, if you look at the history of, for example, antitrust, you know, it's 150 years old, the legislation, and it keeps on evolving. We never had this technology before Steve Jobs invented the smartphone. Now we have the ability for companies to kind of monitor us 24/7. This is a first step in trying to rein in some of these practices. However, with respect to what consumers are going to have to do, one of the things that I think is underreported about the law is because the law requires businesses to accept what's called a third party opting out for you, what I think is going to happen, and I've talked to companies that have plans to do this, is to develop, companies will develop either a browser plugin or actual browser companies will change their browser and have an opt out right in the browser, which will signal the consumer's intent to every website that you visit, saying, you know, this person doesn't want to have their information sold. So I tend to think that over time what's going to happen is consumers aren't going to have to do a whole lot in order to communicate to businesses, don't sell my information. But then finally, to Dr. King's point, I have always believed that one of the best things I could do is give tools to people like her and other experts in Haley to be able to find out what's going on, because a lot of people don't, you know, pay attention. But the people who do, like Haley and Dr. King, will now be able to use these tools to really find out what's going on and what's happening to your information.
So then let's talk a little bit more about how this will happen, because as you say, Alistair McTaggart, it should get easier for folks. And if I'm not mistaken, Haley Tsukiyama, already some browsers are trying to make it as easy as possible for you to at least tell them that you do not want the company to sell your personal data.
There are
already some banners popping up immediately when you browse websites and things like that.
Yes, I think, you know, some people are certainly trying to make it clear that, you know, people have these rights, and in the Attorney General's sort of regulations about this law, the draft regulations about this law, there is a proposal that, you know, there's an existing sort of browser header called Do Not Track, and so that you could use that as a signal to say that you didn't want to sell information.
So let's just go through some of the key things that you can do. And first of all, if you want to find out just how much data companies have on you, it's something you have been able to do before, but what steps does a consumer need to take?
Yeah, so, you know, consumers should be able to, you know, now reach out to these companies and file a request, so through their website, and you can just say, you know, I want to know the information that you have about me.
So. And what is covered? What constitutes the information? Is it all of it?
Alistair may have a better idea of that.
Sure. And Nina, just to clarify, we actually didn't have that right before this. Some companies were offering it.
Yes.
But many were not. And
right.
Now companies, and by the way, this affects all businesses that do business in California. It's not just online businesses. And so now these companies will have to tell you everything they know about you. I mean, really, and including the inferences they've drawn about you. So it's really a very detailed dive. And when you say to the company, what do you know about me? They have to tell you everything they know about you.
And they have to make that accessible, right? They have to at least make the process, Jennifer King, easy enough for you to be able to contact them and say you'd like it. How are they complying?
Absolutely. And there has to be a way for you to actually do this. And the law stipulates that. What I think we'll see where our mileage typically varies is what the output is, what we actually get in return. And that may be one of the first challenges we see from a consumer perspective, because Alistair is absolutely right in saying that experts like myself and, you know, people in the advocacy community as well as researchers will absolutely use these tools as a way to kind of understand what's happening at a detail level at these companies that maybe we couldn't have before, at least not very easily. But what the average consumer gets back, that may vary in terms of what you can actually do with it, you know, how you understand it. If it's, you know, pages and pages and pages of kind of machine readable data that doesn't make a lot of sense to you, you know, it may actually intimidate you to some extent, but it may not be as helpful to you as we might hope.
And same with the question of finding out what kind of personal information they sold to another company. Could that also come back in this hard to interpret script?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. You know, there's no standard here as to how different companies, you know, collect this data. So, you know, how they return that to you will be really interesting.
And then also, I've been noticing, of course, the option when I go to websites to click on do not sell my information. But I'm guessing it would be hard to know, or at least to make sure that they're not doing this, Jennifer King?
Right. I mean, so there's kind of two pieces here, you know, with do not sell as well as delete. To some extent, I think you're going to have to take their word for it, especially on the deletion front, because, you know, how do you get evidence that they've actually deleted it? And, you know, this is, again, the type of thing where somebody who very carefully, you know, makes these requests and tries to ascertain what the companies are doing might find, you know, if they're not complying, that's when they can actually, you know, lodge a complaint with the Attorney General's office. But with the do not sell, again, you know, how do you know? And I think one of the more challenging things to think about this is that for most consumers, you know, we know the kind of first parties we have relationships. We may be Google users, maybe Facebook users, you know, those companies, you know, they loom large and most of us have kind of direct relationships with them. It's that kind of sea of other companies that are more in the shadows that will be very difficult for at least an individual to understand. If I make a request to company A, you know, are companies B, C, D, E, and F, you know, also not selling my data? You know, how do you track that through these very complicated ecosystems?
Yeah, Haley Tukyan, give us more of a sense of who is part of this sea of other companies, these data brokers whose names we hardly ever know, but who seem to be really doing a lot of the data mining.
Yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of companies that, you know, they comb through records, they buy information off other people. So, you know, absolutely the data brokers, and then they sort of give that information to other companies, health insurance companies, mortgage companies. And so it is a very opaque system that can be very difficult for consumers to have any like visibility into. Dr. King is absolutely right. The hope, of course, is that CCPA just is a first step into shining some light into that broad ecosystem.
Now, there have been reports, Alistair McTaggart, that it is those sort of third-party companies, data brokers, so on, who are particularly affected by this new law, but that the big players whose names we all know, like Google and Facebook and Twitter, are not so much. Was that your intention?
Well, so breaking that into two, yes, I think the companies that are just outright buying and selling your information, you're going to have a lot of rights to tell them to stop that. So I think that business is going to be difficult, and I think they're going to play lots of games saying, well, we're just let's all pseudonymize your name. We'll call Dr. King 123, and if we all call her 123, it's going to be okay because we're not actually calling her Dr. King. I think that's clearly not the intention or the spirit of CCPA, and so over time, I think that practice will diminish and get eradicated, and people who want to take control will be able to. With respect to Google and Facebook, you know, I think the what people may not know is that in general, when you're out browsing the internet, every single site you visit is sending back information about your visit to Google, to Facebook, to Twitter, to name sort of three of the largest data aggregators. This allows them to know so much about you and allows them to compile this very deep dossier on you that allows them to be, frankly, more effective in terms of selling ads to you. The ability that you're going to have to tell all those other companies, hey, don't send my information back to Google and Facebook for them to use. I want to visit XYZ, fine. That doesn't mean that Google or Facebook should get to know about that and be able to use that visit. That, I think, is going to have a tremendous impact on improving your privacy over time. Mm. But no, my intention was never to, you know, put put a company out of business. Some people have said they're disappointed that it doesn't do more to sort of negatively impact Google. And my point was never that that was – I didn't start off saying, oh, I need to put something out of business. I started off saying consumers need rights. And if a consumer continues to go back and visit Google and wants to use their services, well, then great if they like that. But to get back to Haley's point, I think people understand that they're doing business with one business. The tricky part is when they think they're visiting a website to read about the news and actually their information is being sold to hundreds of companies they've never heard of. That's the part that we're trying to address.
Well, I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation. We're talking about California's new data privacy law that took effect the first of the year. It's aimed at giving Californians more rights over their personal information, how it's used, sold, etc. And if you have questions for our guests, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. We're talking with Jennifer King. She's Director of Consumer Privacy at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Alistair McTaggart is with us. He's president of Emerald Fund, Inc. and founder of Californians for Consumer Privacy. And Haley Tsukuyama, she is a legislative activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She is with us as well. Jennifer King, can you just explain a little more what Alistair McTaggart was talking about in terms of the way that Facebook and Google are not seen as entities that are selling our information to advertisers, or at least how they're interpreting that that's what they do?
Right. They're kind of the 800-pound gorillas in the room, if you want to think of it that way, in that they certainly collect our data, but basically what they then turn around and do is sell access to our data. And so I think a lot of people misunderstand that, and they tend to assume that those companies are collecting it and selling it. And essentially what they're doing is they're collecting it, and they do a very good job of doing so and create extremely comprehensive profiles of, you know, who we are, what we think we might want, you know, our actual behaviors in the real world, and so on. And then they basically market that to other companies. And their kind of outsized presence in these markets have made them obviously the under scrutiny, you know, for their practices in terms of antitrust, because they have so much power in that marketplace, their ability to kind of set prices and to really have a chokehold on what other companies can do in order to reach consumers. And that doesn't say that, you know, that doesn't mean to say there's not a lot of other actors in this ecosystem, but they're certainly the two biggest. And again, it's about selling the access to their users rather than selling their users' data.
And so do you agree with that interpretation of the law and that the reason that they are not affected by it to the same degree as other companies?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't believe they are probably affected by the do not sell piece. I mean, still, you can ask them to delete your data. You can ask them to tell you what data they have about you. And that could be a really interesting outcome, you know, given the depth of data that they collect. You know, a lot of requests I imagine you make to other companies, you're not going to get a whole lot back, you know, because their analytics potentially aren't quite as sophisticated or as in depth, or they aren't working with as many data points as other companies. So those different rights that you have that you can take advantage of, I think they still may yield a lot of interesting insights as to what these companies are doing. But yes, that opting out of data selling. I mean, although Alistair can speak to this, I'm sure, in terms of the fact that, you know, a sale is not just a sale. And I think that's been one of the more interesting contentious points about this law, is that they wrote it, I believe, with a intentionally broad definition of sale to encompass a lot of different practices that we see among these types of data brokers that isn't just a, here, I'll give you 100 names and you pay me $100.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of kind of in-kind transfers. There are, you know, relationships that you may have from one company to affiliate companies. And so, again, Alistair should probably speak to this more, but I believe the intent was to try to capture a range of different behaviors. So it wasn't just this narrow, you know, you give me money, I give you names. Because we think, or I think we all know, that the practices that these companies engage in are much more sophisticated than that.
So then speak to this, Alistair McTaggart. Sale, what does sale mean to you?
Well, Dr. King is completely right in the sense that sale is not, and it's intentionally not just I'm going to hand you a name, you hand me money. People feel that they're on their phone, they're on one website, they're looking for something. 6 hours later, they're on their work or home computer, and they're on a different website, and the same thing they were searching for, the vacation to Machu Picchu, whatever it is, pops up. People feel like, okay, for sure, that information was sold. And the trope has been, oh, no, we didn't sell anything. We just shared it, or we just put access to it. And that's the part that I think CCPA is going to get back to all sites that you visit will not be able to share your information if you tell them not to. I think that's going to have a dramatic impact on the ability of the Googles and Facebooks of the world to track you from site to site. And I think that's going to have a really beneficial thing, impact on consumer privacy.
Well, we've got calls coming in, and I want to go to Nancy in Oakland. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. My question is, how does an individual prove that they are themselves in order to gain access to this information about the data that's been collected on them?
Great question, Nancy. And Haley Tsukuyama, I mean, basically they have to give more information about themselves, right, to prove that who they are and the data that they want.
Well, it depends on company to company. I think, if you have a username and password, like an account with a company, that's like a pretty good way to verify. But it depends on how the companies are going to implement it. In some cases, companies are asking for your driver's license information, for example.
Jennifer King, if you ask a company not to sell your data, there was concern that there would be ramifications to the consumer, maybe in the form of services or benefits. What does the law say about this?
Right. The law basically prohibits companies from discriminating against you for exercising these rights. And I'm not sure if Alistair or Haley have a little bit more depth, but on bottom line, they're not supposed to prejudicially price against you if you avail yourself to one of these rights.
And so, but they can create additional incentives, Haley Tsukuyama, so that you are deterred from trying to have them stop selling your information?
Well, there is a part of the law that sort of says, kind of depending on the value of the data. And I've already referenced there's an attorney general's process right now, sort of finalizing.
Yes, and I definitely want to get into enforcement after the break.
Sure, but because sort of finalizing how they're going to look at this regulation. So I think we're going to get a little more clarity on that. But yeah, the basic idea is that you cannot be discriminated against for exercising these rights.
But companies, even after you ask them to stop collecting information or selling your information, they can keep collecting that information, right, Alistair McTaggart, as long as you keep using the service again,
right,
going to the site again?
And I think that's just to kind of revisit that, that's a difference in architecture about our law versus, say, GDPR, where my worry about GDPR, which is the European privacy law, the much-vaunted privacy law that came into effect in 2018, is if you've ever been on a European website and you have all the what they call them cookie walls, these pop-ups come up and say, we're going to collect your information, yes or no, allow us to. And if you say no, you basically don't get to use the site or the app. And my worry about that is people, in their sort of hurriedness to want to use X or Y or want to get the car outside the bar at 1 in the morning, are just going to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, it's sort of back to square one.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Hold that thought, and we'll get to you after the break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. California's data privacy law, the California Consumer Protection Act, or CCPA, went into effect on January 1st, and it's considered the toughest privacy law in the nation. But what it does, how you'll benefit, and what's next for the law is what we're digging into in this hour of Forum. And we're joined by Haley Tsukuyama. She's a legislative activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Jennifer King, she's director of consumer privacy at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And Alistair McTaggart, he's president of Emerald Fund Incorporated and founder of Californians for Consumer Privacy. And of course, we're joined by you, our listeners. You can call us at 866-733-6786 with your questions or comments about the new law. You can post them on Facebook, on Twitter, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Robert writes, for example, the simple standard for all web interactions should be opt-in. Anything less, even the improved new law where we have to spend time actively defending our privacy, is a failure. I mean, he brings up the opt-in option. That, of course, is part of the GDPR that you brought up, Alistair McTaggart, the General Data Protection Regulation that's in Europe. But you were talking about how the CCPA is different from that, if you wanted to finish that thought.
Yeah, thanks. you know, the thing with opt-in is everybody says, oh, it should be opt-in, and it sounds, I think, simplistically appealing. Oh, you should get my permission before you collect it. But the problem is then in GDPR, once they have your permission, then they're sort of back to square one. What I wanted to be able to do was to say, not really have to worry about reading privacy policies and just be able to say to companies, don't sell my information. And actually, I think it's simpler because at one level, I do kind of know who I'm doing business with. If I go to Google or Uber or Lyft, I understand that they're going to collect my information. What I don't either understand or want is that it's going to go to hundreds of other companies and I've never heard of. And so what we allow is the ability to signal to those companies, don't sell my information. It feels more like there's the choice of being able to use the company, to use the services, but also be able to tell them not to sell your information. That feels like a better consumer right than just being notified that they're going to collect your information, because then it's sort of like, well, so what? Okay, now you've told me, thanks, now what do I do?
Right.
But so that's why we went this road.
Yes. If the companies do sell your information after you've asked them not to, Alistair McTaggart, that is not grounds to sue under CCPA, right?
That is not a consumer private right of action, which is a fancy way of saying like a class action lawsuit. Correct. However, that is a fine of $2,500 per instance enforced by the Attorney General. And what people don't really, they haven't really done the math, because everybody talks about GDPR again, oh, it's 4% of annual turnover. That's the maximum fine there. Annual revenue, that's a big fine. But our fines quickly dwarf those fines if a company is actively involved in doing this sort of and just ignoring consumer requests. Because if I take Dr. King's information and I sell her location and her search history and her browsing history, that's three pieces of information. If I do that 10 times, that's 30 times. And so it adds up so quickly. So the nature of how this information is transacted in means the fines quickly rise to being extraordinary. And I think that's what, whenever people sort of say, oh, well, you only have Attorney General enforcement, I always say, well, as a business person, anytime the Attorney General has the power to enforce a fine that could potentially, you know, equal like the revenues of these companies, this is attention grabbing. I don't think there's any real company out there that's going to look at these fines or this architecture and say, oh, we're just going to ignore it. Because I think that is potentially existential for these companies. And so I'm satisfied with the Attorney General regulating most of the act, and I think the fines are attention getting for any CEO running these businesses right now.
Well, Jennifer King, though, there is a question of the extent to which Attorney General Javier Becerra will exercise his enforcement rights. Can you talk about the state of enforcement right now?
Well, I mean, with regards to this act, we probably won't see enforcement until after June 30th. Although, to my understanding, if a company is knowingly violating the law, starting, you know, as of yesterday or the day before, January 1st, they could potentially be held accountable. But the regulations themselves are not final, and the Attorney General's office has until July 1st to post the final regulations. But, I mean, we've seen more or less, I think, the skeleton and most of the meat on the bones. So I don't know how much they'll change from what's been published to date. But I do think there are some, you know, really good questions around the capacity of the Attorney General's office in terms of staffing and funding. I mean, I know that's one of the first objections Attorney General Becerra made, I think, when the act was being either negotiated or when it first passed, that it didn't come with funding to, you know, build out a privacy office and, you know, additional attorneys and kind of an enforcement team. So I don't know where that stands in terms of what the legislature's response will be going forward, but I think that is kind of one area that we really haven't seen, you know, heard much discussion about how well the Attorney General's office will be able to conduct enforcement.
Yes. And so are you optimistic, Haley Tsukuyama, that they will be able to conduct enforcement well or in a way that will be enough for companies to make sure, you know, that they are being good actors in this space with your data?
Well, so, you know, I hate to speak for the Attorney General's office. We, as privacy advocates, also have concerns about sort of centralizing just about capacity, right, to be able to take on these cases. I think the Attorney General's office will choose their cases wisely. But, you know, we did support a bill in the last legislature to expand the individual right to sue, the private right of action, to all violations of CCPA. And I think there are a lot of ways we'd like to see enforcement kind of pass to other offices as well.
But that really is the big question right around this law, is what will enforcement look like?
Yeah. And, you know, I think I do have capacity concerns about the Attorney General's office.
Well, let me go to our listeners and start with Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter.
Yes. Hi, it's Peter Warfield from Library Users Association. I'm wondering what's going on with or how this will affect, for example, public institutions like the library, which is in San Francisco now putting RFID tags on books, which risks other people who have access to the technology knowing what people, what a particular person is reading, and also where they go with the book. And another thing that the library does is they installed a social media-like catalog which invites people to comment on books, for example. That's BiblioCommons, and that also seems like something that others would be very interested in mining at times.
Alistair McTaggart, do you have an answer for Peter?
The California Consumer Privacy Act only regulates businesses. It doesn't regulate state agencies or nonprofits. And a lot of people said, well, why didn't you do that? And my answer was I was trying not to, you know, boil the ocean at the time when we were first starting off here. I tried to do one thing and do it to the best of my ability. So that's why we deal with businesses. With respect to the what the gentleman raised about the library, that which is interesting, is to the extent that the library is using a commercial service provider to install the RFID chips or to harvest data from all of its readers, that will be subject to the law. So that's kind of, people don't really focus on that, but we kind of get in there through the back door with respect to governments farming out surveillance work, if that's what they're doing. You'll be able to approach those entities that are doing the work on the government's behalf.
And just to give a little more detail to Peter about the companies that are subject to these rules, it has to have at least $25 million in revenue and make at least half of its money by selling data or gathering information on at least 50,000 customers. This is something that Haley Tsukiyama touched on at the top of the show. Thanks, Peter, for the question. And let me go next to Tom in Castro Valley. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was curious about foreign entities, especially face-sharing apps like the one in Russia where a lot of our kids were using to make themselves look older. And I don't have any trust in either the Russian or Chinese governments, as well as their supervision and their own, you know, ability to take information from their quasi-private companies, especially in regards to our children. After all, they do have the Great Firewall of China, and they can do it on their own citizens. How does this impact foreign entities?
Tom, thank you. Jennifer King?
So that's an excellent question. And so to the extent that these companies have U.S. customers, or actually California residents as their customers, it arguably should affect them. Practically speaking, I don't know what that actually looks like in terms of enforcement, for example, if we're dealing with a Russian company that has California residents as its customers, you know, how you can actually enforce the law against a company in another country. But certainly, in theory, that should apply. And to some extent, with apps, for example, it might be that there ends up being some pressure on the app stores, or potentially gating by the app stores themselves, where an app might be able to say, I don't want Californians or California residents, you know, however that's determined, to be able to download my app because I don't want them as customers. So I don't actually know for sure how that can be resolved, but that's one way I could imagine a company could try to bypass it, is just refuse to offer those services to Californians.
Well, Tom, thank you for the question. And also, I feel like this is a great time, Jennifer King, just to talk about the influence or the reach of a California law in terms of, I mean, not even just you know, nationally, because of course it's prompting more or motivating, I think, more states to consider privacy laws of this kind, which then, of course, is spurring the federal government to look at something that's more uniform. So can you just talk about how what California does ends up affecting not just the nation, but even, you know, global actors?
Right. Yeah. So we are, what, the fifth largest economy, I think, is the last time I heard that stat. So, yeah, what we do really does have an impact. Now, on the global stage, in terms of privacy, we're not, this law is not likely to be the model for what other countries are doing. The GDPR in Europe is really the driving force right now in the global conversations on privacy, and especially by other countries that want to do business in Europe and achieve what's called GDPR adequacy. So because there isn't a similar requirement in California, it's not likely that these provisions will become kind of the driving force in the conversation on global privacy. I think the GDPR really has probably, you know, taken that position. But it's certainly, you know, a lot of people do business with Californians. And so it's definitely going to raise questions around compliance and certainly open the door to thinking through about how, you know, how we should tackle these privacy questions. You know, I think one of the biggest things to consider in how we think about privacy and privacy laws is that something like the GDPR takes privacy as a human right. You know, it's coming from this human rights-based approach, whereas in the U.S., traditionally, we come at it from kind of a consumer protection approach. And so, and I would argue that the CCPA also, you know, works within that consumer protection framework. But it really, I think, it positions a kind of a showdown, if you want to think of it that way, on how we approach privacy. And it's certainly going to spur a lot of conversation at the federal level. It already has, and certainly will more. And I don't know if Alistair is going to talk at all about the potential ballot initiative they're raising for this year, part two, if you want to call it that, which I think will definitely spur more conversation on how we approach privacy legislatively.
Well, I definitely do want to get to that. But Alistair McTaggart, could you also answer Gemmill's question, which is, can you spend more time talking about the impact of businesses and how they're going to be able to comply with this law? Is a small business, either online or not, now supposed to be able to react to hundreds of data requests?
Well, we, as Haley mentioned, and as you referenced, we have essentially a floor below which we say businesses shouldn't have to comply with the law, because that's not where the problem is. We try to, you know, address the issue, which is these giant, by and large, data aggregating companies, and or companies that are small, but that's all they do. And so that's really how we approach the, should the small business have to comply with this? And we tried to say, no, tiny little businesses that aren't buying and selling your data shouldn't have to comply, and actually not that tiny, under $25 million in revenue, or unless you get half your, your revenue from selling information. So that's, we tried to take the approach that we're regulating big businesses. And then just to get to the, you know, the previous point, it doesn't matter whether you're in Tel Aviv or Tokyo, you have to comply if you're doing business with California. And to Dr. King's point, my bet and my hypothesis always has been no one can willingly ignore the fifth largest economy in the world. And I also think that it's unsustainable for a real business to park themselves in Moscow and just or anywhere and continue to do business in California in violation of the law, because what will happen is you'll get to them through the Play Store, through Google, or through Apple. In some way, they will not be able to continue to flout the law here in California.
And Alistair McTaggart is the founder of Californians for Consumer Privacy, and it was his original ballot measure that was the starting point for the CCPA. And Alistair McTaggart, talk about the ballot measure that you have, part two, as Jennifer King mentioned. What is in it? What are you trying to do with it?
Well, I think precisely to what Dr. King just was referencing in terms of the GDPR being sort of the world standard. In many respects, the second version of California, the Privacy Rights Act, will harmonize California privacy law with that world, that first world of privacy, so to speak, which, you know, the European Union, Japan, New Zealand, all these countries have what's called adequate data protection regimes. And so, for example, we will now create this notion of sensitive personal information. information that's so sensitive that really you can tell a company don't use it. That would be your race, your ethnicity, your health, your biometrics, your sexual orientation, and importantly, like your precise geolocation. So you'd be able to say, actually, you can't use that for advertising where I am, because that's the technology, Nina, that allows me to track you into your rehab clinic or into the gym and to find out how long you're there, or into the reproductive, you know, clinic to find out if you're visiting that. And so that it'll create that. It would create a new privacy protection agency and actually fund it in statute and at a funding level that should equate to as many privacy protection professionals in California enforcing the law as right now exist at the federal government level and FTC for the entire country.
Curious what the status is of this effort?
So we filed the initiative with the Attorney General. We received our title and summary a couple of weeks ago, and we are out on the streets gathering signatures. So if anybody meets the signature gatherer, they can hopefully sign our petition. So we have until early May to get our signatures.
Well, let me go next to Paul in Davis. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, can.
Great. I don't mean to throw water on your parade on this, but I have an incredible skeptic on this entire endeavor, and here's my reasoning. Is I consistently, as do many people, sign up with services. So you read the disclosures as they are given to you at the time, which are oftentimes too hugely complex for the average person to even get their heads around. And then some weeks later or sometime later, you receive an email from them saying, our terms of privacy have changed. We are updating these services, updating these changes. And unless you go to the links and look at what they're doing, you have no idea what the changes are or any ability to act upon those. The second part of my question is affiliates. I'm contracting with a company or I'm literally providing my data to a company, and within that they say, we are sharing my data with affiliates, and those affiliates change over time. I have no idea who those affiliates are. Again, my question is really, what's the protection that really exists for the individual consumer who can navigate around that? And I'll leave it at that and let you comment.
Well, Haley Tsukiyama, I mean, so many people feel Paul's pain here. Can you respond to his concern?
Yeah, I mean, so I certainly hear that concern. It's a concern I share. You know, CCPA is a great first step. I think, as I said, like it shines a little bit of light into this ecosystem. You can say, you know, you mentioned affiliates. Like, you can actually say, who are those people? Or what are those like types of companies that you're sharing information with? You can get to know some of that. And then you're better armed with information to say, you now know that they have your information. You can ask them to delete it, that sort of thing. So it's not a perfect solution by any measure. I certainly understand that people feel overwhelmed by managing their own privacy, but it is an important first step.
Well, Joe in Oakland, join us. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You've been, all your callers have been saying pretty much the same thing, is that me as an individual, there's just no way I can figure out all the links between Google and every other little company that they've done business with and that they've done business with, et cetera. So I'm just wondering if one of these days some company, even if I have to pay them, some company will say, okay, I can follow all that for you. I can comply with your instructions if you want every single one of them to dump as much data as possible or whatever your wishes are. I just like to have one phone call to make as opposed to becoming a data expert, which will never happen.
Joe, thanks. And Haley Tsukiyama, I'm sure that this has been thought of by folks who are seeing a need out there, an unmet need.
Yeah, I mean, I think, one hope is that certainly this law will, now that we've established these rights, that this law will allow for innovation for companies to come in and do some of that information do some of that work for you. There is, of course, verification issues that have to be worked out. But like, I definitely, I see that as a possibility.
Jennifer King, do you have anything to add to that?
Oh, yeah. Yes. You know, Alistair mentioned at the top of the show about the do not track provision in this law, or at least how the regulations are interpreting using do not track, which I think is a really is potentially a game changer. It's very forward thinking in that, as you know, my sweet spot is privacy research. And I grapple with the issues that your callers are raising, you know, such as, you know, privacy policies are not written for human beings. They're written for lawyers, not that lawyers aren't human, but they're not written for consumers. And there's just no way. I mean, there is no way you can functionally, if you are, you know, a person living your life online, just doing basic services, not even necessarily, you know, spending all your time on Instagram, for example, that you can track and manage all of these different companies and your relationships with them. So I do think we are at a turning point where we need incentives, potentially policy incentives, to spur that type of kind of computerized or digitized management of how we interact with these companies. I think one of the real challenges, though, is that if you think about how we access the internet and different apps and services, you know, it's tied up in a handful of different platforms. And so the incentives of a Google, for example, to implement something like Do Not Track or to give you more tools to you know, protect your privacy is going to be a hard sell versus a Mozilla, you know, which is, you know, an independent browser. And is really taking, I think, a lot of solid steps in terms of trying to use ways within the browser to protect individual privacy. And the same thing with, you know, mobile platforms. You know, most everyone uses either Android, which is made by Google, or iOS, which is made by Apple. Apple's made some more aggressive moves in terms of protecting consumer privacy because they are arguing that they are not in the business of monetizing personal information. And so with those gatekeepers in place, it makes it difficult to kind of crack open the market for creating these ways for to create tools to allow people to do this. But I do think it's the future, if nothing else, because we're at a point where we just simply on an individual basis cannot manage this type of data.
Well, Brian writes, and it's a point that we touched on earlier, but we'll bring it up again for a little more clarity. Brian writes, there's a difference between making money from personal information and selling information for money. Is it fair to say that the law only applies to selling personal information instead of using personally identifiable information to make money? Alistair McTaggart, can you respond to Brian?
Well, I think we don't distinguish between personal information and personally identifiable information, so I don't know. But as I said earlier, we are really trying to regulate the transfer of information between companies on the understanding that you kind of know who you're doing business with in the first party, so to speak, but that what you want to be able to do is stop them from selling it. And just to kind of circle back on what was being talked about before, yes, I agree that that would be very complicated if you had to leave it up to every individual consumer and had to click every single time on every single website and find out where to click. Over time, I think that the button, the do not sell button, will become more visible. It hasn't, the regulations haven't even been finalized on that yet. But then, I'm convinced that over time, there will develop a really active ecosystem of businesses that will opt out and manage this for you, just like Joe was saying. Mm-hmm. And whether you pay them a fee or they have some other way of revenue monetizing their services, they'll go around and opt out for you. And that's why, when I wrote it, the standard for opting out, the verification standard, is very low. It's not the same as being able to get your information or delete your information, because the consequences are completely different. If I can pretend to be Dr. King and delete all her photos, that's terrible. If I can pretend to be Dr. King and say, don't sell my information, it's sort of like, well, who gets, you know, so big deal. And so we allow the browsers. And so Haley's organization, EFF, for example, has a great tool, privacy management tool called Privacy Badger. Well, maybe they will. It's a plugin into your browser. So maybe EFF will come out with a plugin that says, oh, okay, we'll now help you manage your do not sell preferences, and you can plug it into your browser just like Privacy Badger, or it'll become a part of Privacy Badger, and it will now tell everybody that you visit don't sell their information. So I think over time businesses will grow to make money from this area because we now enable it. And it won't matter whether Google wants to implement it or not. They'll have to respect the law, because it'll be the law. So that's my point, was to try to make it easy for consumers to manage their privacy and give an incentive to other businesses to help them manage it.
Well, I'm going to end with Sue's question. You know, it really speaks to just the fact that this is, there are so many questions about how data is transferred and how data is collected. And Sue says, how does agreeing to allow a site to use location services affect the current conversation? Even Fandango asked this question with every new page I navigate on its site. Jennifer King?
Right. The New York Times, right before the Christmas holidays, produced a very compelling report on the use of location information that I would highly recommend on this topic, just to give you a really detailed illustration about how location information is used, although I think that was mobile and not necessarily browser-based location requests. And actually, there's maybe not an entirely clear answer here, because if it's a mobile request, you know, it's happening through an app, that's, I think, a substantively different request than if it's happening through a browser, if you're on a desktop computer or a laptop and a site's asking for your location, because how they obtain the location is going to be different. If you're on a mobile phone, then, you know, a combination of GPS plus wireless plus Bluetooth gives you a very, very precise physical location, whereas if a site's asking you for location information through a browser, it will kind of generally get a sense of where you are, usually through your IP address, but not necessarily the kind of precise location, like where you are sitting, you know, in your home.
Well, Jennifer King, Alistair McTaggart, and Haley Tsukuyama, thank you, and thanks to our listeners.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.